So the discussion we're going to have today is on, as Christians, how do we approach the civic religious holidays of our nation? What does it mean to come into these things as Christians and finding aspects that we see in the Psalms and in the life of the church of both thanksgiving and of lament? Now, is there anyone in here who's not American? Okay, where are you from? Okay. Canada's history is very similar to America's, just more passive-aggressive. So you'll find a lot of what I think we're talking about here. But I would love to hear some of your thoughts on some holidays that we have in Canada, that you have in Canada, that might coincide or go alongside with what we're talking about here in America. So I want to start this session just by taking a few minutes to make a list. Let's make a list of some of our nation's civic religious holidays. What are the holidays that we celebrate as a nation about our past, about our people in our government or in our history, that as a nation we come together to celebrate? So who can list some of these days for me? Thanksgiving, okay? There's no rules here, so we can make a list. Anything else? Sunshine's here. All right. That's okay. Anything else that we would like to add into this list? Labor Day?
Super Bowl Sunday.
Super Bowl Sunday? That you are actually quite correct there. Anything else that we're missing? We're missing one fairly important one, but Family Day, okay. We're missing one more that I want to make sure we get on here.
Valentine's Day.
Not necessarily civic religious day. How about Lincoln's birthday? Oh, that is, you're right. That is the same as President's Day. Okay.
Is Veterans Day similar to Remembrance Day for us?
Yeah, it is.
November.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, so what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and I'm going to have Soonchan talk to you for a few minutes about lament, because I think we all understand the aspects of Thanksgiving, of giving thanks, but we don't have as much of a in-depth spiritual understanding of the discipline of lament. So Soonchan's going to address some of that, and then he's going to talk about some history that he brings in to our nation. That he talks about from our nation's history regarding people of color, specifically African Americans. And then I'm going to talk about another set of our history that we tend to not be fully aware of. So I'm going to pass the mic off to Soonchan.
Some of you know that I wrote a book in 2015. Actually, it was a 20-year process, but the book came out in 2015 on Lamentations. It was a book called Prophetic Lament. It's on InterVarsity Press. And the intention of the book was to try to reintroduce a lost worship discipline and worship art, worship practice, which is the practice of lament. I opened the book talking about the way that lament has been lost in our, especially Western culture. I look at the study of Denise Hopkins at Wesley Seminary. She was looking at the six liturgical traditions in the United States that included Catholic, Episcopalian, Episcopalian, Anglican, Lutheran, Methodist, and there were two other denominations. And these denominations will be denominations that are kind of guided by liturgy. They're assigned texts and assigned hymns and psalms that you're supposed to read. And what Dr. Hopkins found was that even when there were assigned lament psalms or hymns to incorporate into worship, these liturgical traditions and churches would skip over them and replace them with happier laments and happier hymns. Glenn Pemberton did a study on the use of hymns and lament in the hymns. And what he noted was that in the Psalms, 150 Psalms that we have in the Old Testament, 60% of the Psalms are Psalms of celebration, and 40% of our Psalms are Psalms of lament and suffering. And what he notes is that if you look at a typical Baptist or Presbyterian hymnal, 85% of those hymns would be hymns of celebration, and only 15% of the hymns would be hymns of suffering and lament. And that's just what's in the hymnals and not counting what's actually sung in the church. That number I would guess is maybe even lower than the number of hymns in the hymnal. So I looked at CCLI, which is the Christian Copyright Licensing Incorporated, and they, of course, keep track and license churches to project contemporary worship songs. So if you're using contemporary worship songs, you get a CCLI license, you put a little number at the bottom of your screen, and then you project the words, and you have to actually report those songs to let CCLI know, because they distribute 1/100th of a penny for someone who wrote a song. I don't know what it is. It's probably not a whole lot. But it's a way to kind of license and give copyright protection for songwriters. I looked at, and so what they do with this list, they get this input, is they publish every year the top 100 most popular contemporary worship songs that are used in American churches. And of the top 100, I would argue maybe 5, maybe 10 of those top 100 songs would be songs about lament. So what we're seeing in these three traditions, whether it is the liturgical tradition, whether it is the hymn, traditional worship tradition, or the contemporary worship approach, we're seeing in each of these categories of worship styles, significant absence of lament. And that will be kind of the common thread that runs through the American church. So the problem then is we are missing a very significant aspect and discipline of worship practice in our church life. What gets lost then if you don't have lament in your church? Well, one of the major things that get lost is you have an imbalanced theology, because you're presenting a theological framework that favors the voice of the privileged and favors this kind of triumphalistic, victorious, success-oriented narrative. Let's make it clear. It is in the Bible, right? Jesus did rise from the grave, and Jesus will come in triumphant return. But if that's the only part of the Bible you're reading, you're getting an insufficient theology, because Jesus rose from the grave because he first went to the grave, and he had to come into the world because of the brokenness of humanity. And that's why in the Psalms you get 60% of celebration, but you also get 40% of lament and suffering. So what we lose in the absence of lament is a very significant part of our theology. One of the other ways of looking at it is to say, when you have the absence of lament, you don't leave room for the non-privileged voices in our society. Like I said, I wrote a commentary on the Book of Lamentations, and one of the more intriguing features of the Book of Lamentations is that there's a question about the authorship. So Jeremiah, Lamentations, are kind of back-to-back. Because of the context of Lamentations, the people of God have been sent away into exile, and the ones they sent into exile were sent into exile were actually those that we would identify as leaders in the community, those who could read or write, those who the Babylonians deemed as having the potential to rebuild Jerusalem. But what we do know is that that's where, of course, where we encounter the story of Daniel and the lions then, all that kind of stuff, Daniel and his friends. So the ones that were left in Jerusalem were actually the widows, the orphans, the crippled, the lame, the blind, the sick, those who Babylon deemed as incapable of rebuilding Jerusalem. So all the able-bodied, intelligentsia, those who could read or write, are in exile in Babylon, and probably the only candidate who would have the capacity to write the Book of Lamentations would be Jeremiah. Jeremiah was allowed to stay behind because if you look at the book of Jeremiah, he supports Babylonian conquest of Jerusalem. He says to Jerusalem, give in to the Babylonians because you're being justifiably judged, so give in to the Babylonians. Babylonians knew that. They allowed Jeremiah to stay behind and not be sent away into exile. So in terms of an actual candidate to write the book of Lamentations, Jeremiah would be that candidate. However, if an Old Testament scholar or Hebrew scholars have looked at the book of Jeremiah and compared it to the book of Lamentations, and if you compare the writing style of these two books, they are so markedly different that it seems like there's no way that the same person could have written these two books. I compare it to Shakespeare and Tupac. Both are great poets. They just have slightly different styles of writing. So if you were to read Shakespeare and then read Tupac or listen to Tupac, you would say, yeah, that's great poetry. It's just not the same guy that's writing both of those works. So what you end up with is a clear distinction between Jeremiah and Lamentation. So how is it that Jeremiah is probably the only one who could have written the book, but the style of writing does not match Jeremiah's style of writing? Well, the answer is pretty simple. Jeremiah is probably the writer of the book, but not in the sense of it's not his story. He's actually the curator and the editor of other stories. Now, there are moments where the prophetic narrator comes in and says, I'm observing this as an outsider. But what Jeremiah does is he goes to the city gate, which is where all the people gather, like a town hall. And all the ones that have been really damaged and hurt and crushed by this attack by the Babylonians, they come out and they start telling their stories. And of course, they are the widows, the orphans, the lame, the sick, those who've been left behind, those who are the most marginalized, the most suffering, and the weakest of that community. They're the ones that come out to the city square, the city gate, and they start telling their stories. And Jeremiah, again, probably the only person who could read or write, or one of the few who were left behind, starts writing down their stories. What I point out about Lamentations is that it is, first of all, I think it's the most feminine book of the Bible, more so than maybe even Ruth and Esther, because the voices of women really emerge front and center in the book of Lamentations. That's one of the authorship issues of, there's so many women's voices that emerge out of this. And a big reason for that is in conquest and in kind of war, it really is the women and children that suffer the most. And that's what's being evident in the book of Lamentations. The voices of women, the lamentations of the women are rising up as folks are experiencing this trauma. And it really is Jeremiah, who is in a position of privilege as a male, as someone who can read or write, who yields that privilege so that the voice of the marginalized can be elevated. I really, really wish American evangelicalism would take the example of Jeremiah, where we are not always elevating the voice of the privilege, which if we kind of look over here, that's what we end up doing. We end up celebrating the voices of the privilege, when actually maybe the scripture talks about hearing the voices of those who have been previously silenced. And that is also what's happening in the church context, where we are elevating the privileged voices, and yet we are suppressing the lament of those who have suffered. So what the Book of Lamentations and the Lament Psalms offer us is the real strong necessity to engage the wide range of voices that are in our communities. And I would argue that without the full range of voices expressed in your worship through lament, through suffering, and through celebration, you are giving a theological deficiency. You are expressing a theological deficiency in your congregation. You are not allowing for the full expression of the gospel, of Christology, of shalom. You're not giving room for all of that to be expressed. One more comment about the Book of Lamentations, and it'll lead us into this next section. Lamentations chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 4. There are five chapters in the Book of Lamentations. Three of the five chapters in the Book of Lamentations are written in the style of a funeral dirge. I didn't bring the slide with me. There are about nine different characteristics of chapters 1, 2, and 4 that clearly indicate this is a funeral dirge. Bless you. Lament is multi-genre. It's a subset. There are many subsets within lament. So if you study the genre of lament in the Old Testament, you'll find that there's individual laments, there are corporate laments, there are funeral dirges, there's even something called the city lament. There's just a wide subgroup or subgenres of the larger genre of lament. Chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 4 is the larger category of lament, but the specific category, subcategory of the funeral dirge. Now, what happens in a funeral dirge is that you have to acknowledge the reality of a death, right? So the way I compare it for pastors, when you visit a sick person in the hospital, you do not do the same things at a hospital visit that you would do at a funeral service. I certainly hope not, right? So you go to a hospital visit, you hold their hand, you pray, you sing, with the possibility, no matter how sick they are, with the possibility that that person might get better. So in a hospital visit, you have different intention. What you're doing in a hospital room is very different. Now, if you go to the funeral service and you use the same language that you were using in a hospital, that would be very inappropriate, right? In fact, if the person is dead, there's a dead body in the casket, and you say, we're going to just all join hands, sing kumbaya, and this person will be out of the casket tomorrow and back home. That would be very inappropriate to say in a funeral dirge. So this kind of unique genre of the funeral dirge is an important part of lament, to acknowledge that sometimes the answers are not, let's make everything better, let's make this person better, let's feel good about having been here together, which is oftentimes a worship directive, right? Let's make sure at the end of our 58 minutes of worship, of service, that everybody feels better going home, right? It's like when you're watching a television show for an hour, at the end of that hour, we should all feel a little bit better about ourselves. And that becomes our church service. Well, after 58 minutes, all of us should feel a little better about ourselves. And again, in a hospital visit, you actually can get away with that. In a funeral, I'm not sure that's what you're trying to do, because it's dishonoring, first of all, of the dead body that is in the room. What I argue in the Book of Lamentations in my commentary is that that funeral dirge is one of the missing ingredients and gaps in our worship life in the church. And that gap has led to severe deficiency in how we understand race and racism in America. Because racism in America is not just a hospital visit, it is acknowledgement of death. It is acknowledgement of dead bodies. So most of us, most American Christians, view race relations in America as a hospital visit. We join hands, we sing kumbaya, we hug it out, and we love you, man. And then at the end of that visit, everything is better. So we have these wonderful worship service, we swap the choirs, and we do all these things, and we feel good about ourselves, and we pray, and we laugh, and now racism is solved, and the person is out of the hospital, and we can rejoice in that healing that has occurred. The reality, though, is that racism is dead bodies in the room. And those dead bodies are the bodies of black men and women. And so when you are having a hospital visit, it is inappropriate when there's a dead body in the room. You're doing the things that do not make sense when you're doing a hospital visit for what should be a funeral. So I want to just kind of recount for some historical realities of why we have to acknowledge the dead bodies in the room. And some of this is a history that most of us know. Some of it is, I want to confront some alternative facts that are out there about this history. Every time I've kind of talked about this, I inevitably get the random email. I'll tell you about this a little bit later. But let me tell you some of the history that I think we have to acknowledge in our worship. We're dealing with a funeral and not with a hospital. We begin the story, it goes back much earlier than that, but the way that the Europeans came into Africa, viewed African lives as less than human, in fact saw them as chattel labor and slave labor, and kidnapped African slaves and brought them to the castles on the western coast of Africa. Those castles still are there to this day. And if you've seen images or kind of, I've seen places where they reconstructed what those castles look like. They were built to look like tombs. So when you go in, they're built like these tombs. And they have to wade in across the river to get to these, to the shore. A number of African American theologians and scholars have noted what this was attempting to baptize African lives into a place of Western life. And in order to do that, you had to crush the African identity. So Africans are stripped of their identity, their tribal identity. They're separated from their family and from their parents and from their children, because everything that gave them their identity in Africa is now going to be ripped away, because they're about to enter into a new identity as non-human in the new world. Because if you stay with a family member, you stay with your kinship and your tribal identity, that gives you a dignity. So the intentionality of the slave traders was to strip the African of that dignity, of their identity as human beings, as husbands, as wives, as children, and as parents, as members of a larger community. All of those things were stripped away. You wade across the river as if in a baptism. You come to the castle, buried in these tombs, to kill your old self, your African identity, the way God has made you in the image of God. That is being destroyed. One of the first examples of the slave trade, actually, is written up in my mentor's book, Willie Jennings' book on Christian imagination. Willie went to Calvin College, by the way, yeah, and he grew up right here in Grand Rapids. He was at Duke when I studied with him. He's now at Yale University. Jennings talks about one of the very first slave ships that pull up to the coast of Africa. And on this ship is Prince Henry of Portugal. His secretary is someone by the name of Zurara. And Zurara notes what's happening. And what's noted by historians is that Zurara, who was a historian, he was the secretary of that ship, that the page that Zurara writes is wet with tears that he sheds as he watches the beginning of the slave trade. This is in the 16th century. And he sees the Africans marched out of these tombs, of these castles, and they're brought out, and he's weeping because he knows this is not what God had intended for humanity to treat other people. Then he explains something in a very bizarre way. He says, but I know this is wrong, and I'm weeping tears because this is wrong, but I will accept this slave trade, he said, for two reasons. One, my leader is a godly person. And so if my leader, Prince Henry, says this is okay, then it must be okay. So he sees that as permission by assuming his leader is a godly leader, because after all, he's the leader of a Christian nation. If that person is a godly leader, then this atrocity and injustice can be justified. The second thing that he gives is an explanation, a justification, is that Prince Henry, in his act of Christianity, takes a tenth of the slaves he's about to take into possession and offers it as a tithe to the priests that are with him. And so at the onset of the slave trade, you are literally seeing the church giving permission for the slave trade to start and to give, say, this is okay. So the church, instead of being a prophetic witness, this is not of God, actually said to the state, to Prince Henry, this is okay. The slaves are taken into the hull of these slave ships, well documented about what happened there. The slaves are laid side by side. They're not in quarters. They're just kind of like animals or like cargo, just laid side by side. They're taken across the ocean. Many would stage hunger strikes in order to make sure that they wouldn't make it across the ocean. They found implements, which are kind of like reverse tongs, that would pry the mouths open so they could force feed the slaves. Many of the slaves would make if they were ever taken up onto the deck, they would just jump overboard. They would throw dead bodies overboard. Very well documented historically that schools of sharks would follow slave ships because they knew bodies would be thrown over. And so they would pull up, those that survived this brutal transatlantic slave trade, they would pull up to the colonies on the east coast of the United States. And when they would pull up to the colonies on the east coast of the United States, the auction bell would ring to signify that it is time for the slaves to be sold. Frederick Douglass notes that the auction bell would ring in rhythm with the church bells. So as the church bells would ring, the auction bells would ring, the very godly people who had just sung, praise God from whom all blessings flow, who had sung all the beautiful hymns of our rich Christian tradition, would march down to the dock to be participants in the slave trade. That the auction bell would ring in tandem and rhythm with the slave bell, with the church bell. They would take into possession these individuals, separating families, separating tribes, didn't matter at this point. And the slaves would be taken to the plantations in the United States. The plantation life was intentionally built to deprive humanity to these individuals. One of the best ways to deprive humanity, again, is to deprive community. There was an attempt to rebuild life by the slaves, and one of the ways they would do that is to start families. Some of you know in the African American church to this day, there is something called the the process of jumping the broom. Well, that starts in the plantation because marriage was not allowed. You're not allowed to have these identifying, spiritually formative practices that give dignity to these individuals. So they had to invent a process of jumping over a broom to signify that they were married together. Now, the slave owner, of course, would find out about this and discover that, well, I can't have this. I can't have a stability of a family on the plantation. So I would do everything to destroy that family. And it is, again, well documented, the systematic rape of women, especially those who claim to be wives, and the demeaning of the husbands to let them know you have no power in even your own home because I can come and rape your wife at any time. So there was a systematic process of destroying the black family, first in Africa, then in the transatlantic slave trade, and on the plantation themselves. This is why I'm stunned when the rhetoric out there is about how messed up the black family is, or the carnages of our inner city. Let's be honest. The black family is a miracle. Because if any other community had to endure what the African-American community had to endure, the constant, systematic assault on the family life of the black family, no family could have survived that. No family unit can survive 500 years of a constant tearing down of the black family. So I really don't want to hear about, oh, these poor black families. No, every black family is a miracle of God. And that's where we've got to tell the truth. And lament is that truth telling. These histories that have been latent and hidden and brushed aside for so long, these are the stories we need to tell in our lament. I'll turn it back over to Mark.
Okay. Thank you, Xingshan. The next 20 minutes, I want to go through some of American history. But before we can get to some of the American history, we have to go through some of the church history. So in the first to third century, we had the church and we had the empire. They were completely separate. You joined the church through your baptism, your confession, your repentance, your discipleship. And when you joined the church, you knew that you stood in opposition to the empire. You knew there was a good chance you'd be persecuted, possibly even killed, because of your membership in the church. Now, in the fourth century, Constantine became emperor of Rome. And when he became emperor, after he became emperor, he became a Christian. And he decided that he was going to Christianize Rome, create a Christian empire. Now, this was never an intention of Christ. If you read his teachings, if you read the teachings of the New Testament authors, there was never this notion of creating a Christian empire. Jesus talked about the fact that his empire, his kingdom, was not of this earth. He was working for something much better, much further beyond in the future. And so Constantine creates something that was never intended by the early church, which is a Christian empire. And his creation of this Christian empire nearly destroyed the understanding of what it meant to be the church. Now, instead of joining the church through your baptism, your confession, your repentance, and your discipleship, now you join the church through your citizenship in the empire. So this creates a problem because the empire does what empires do. It protects itself and expands its borders through the act of warfare. Well, the simple reading of the Gospels and Jesus' teaching doesn't allow this. So we need theologians like Augustine to come in and do some theological gymnastics to create a justification of why the Christian empire can be acting like a worldly empire. Now, the idea of a just war theory is not a bad idea if you have a separate church speaking prophetically to an empire saying, hey, you have to be more careful about how you're going to war. But that's not what this was. This was a Christian empire justifying why it was at war through a just war theory. So this was condoning its worldly behavior. So over the centuries, a just war theory morphed into the Crusades, which is about expanding the empire and protecting Jerusalem. And then in the 13th century, we see the writings of the papal bulls. They begin to identify a new category of other, the infidel. The infidel was used in reference to the Moors or to the Muslims. Later was applied to indigenous peoples. It's this subhuman category of other. Now, the introduction of the subhuman category, this changes the justification for warfare. Now, instead of needing a just war theory to go to war, now the Christian empire can go to war based on its theological grounds. It's fighting the other. So it's out of this history that in 1452, Pope Nicholas V, writes in a papal bull, invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever. Reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. Convert them to his and their use and profit. This is the first papal bull in a series of papal bulls between 1452 and 1493 that collectively become known as the Doctrine of Discovery. The Doctrine of Discovery is basically the church in Europe saying to the nations of Europe, wherever you go, whatever land you find not ruled by Christian rulers, those people are less than human, and the land's yours for the taking. So this was the doctrine that allowed European nations to go into Africa, enslave the African people. This was also the doctrine that allowed Columbus, who was lost at sea, to land in a new world already inhabited by millions and claim to have discovered it. If you think about it, you cannot discover lands that are already occupied. If you don't believe me, leave your purses, your cell phones, your wallets in front of you. I'll come by and discover them. Clearly, that's not discovery. That's stealing. The fact that to this day we refer to what Columbus did as discovery reveals the implicit racial bias of the country, which is Native peoples are not fully human. This makes the doctrine of discovery a racist doctrine, and it's the fruit of the church getting into bed, prostituting itself out to the empire. Now, in 1763, King George drew a line down the Appalachian Mountains, and he said to the colonists, you no longer have the right of discovery of the empty Indian lands west of Appalachia. This upset the colonists. They wanted access to those lands. They wanted the right to discover them. So a few years later, they wrote a letter of protest. In their letter, they accused the king of raising the conditions of new appropriations of land. They went on in their letter to state that he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages. They signed their letter on July 4th, 1776. Literally 30 lines below the statement, all men are created equal, the Declaration of Independence refers to natives as merciless Indian savages, making it very clear the only reason our founding fathers used this inclusive term, all men, because they had a very narrow definition of who was and who was not human. So this, of course, makes our declaration a racist document that assumes the dehumanization of people of color. Now, a few years later, our founding fathers wrote another document. They started this document by saying, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. This, of course, is the preamble to the Constitution. Well, Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution, the section that determines who is and who is not covered by this Constitution, who is and who is not included in this union, we have to note, first of all, it never mentions women. Second, it specifically excludes natives. And third, it counts Africans as 3/5 of a person. So literally, we the people means white landowning men. Now, we have to stop and pause and think about that. The purpose of the Constitution, as it was written, was to protect the rights of white landowning men. So today, we should not be surprised that women earn 70 cents to the dollar. The Constitution's working. We should not be surprised that our prisons are filled with people of color. The Constitution's working. We should not be shocked that in 2010, the Supreme Court sided with Citizens United and ruled that corporations now have the same rights to political free speech as individuals, opening the door to super PACs and unlimited contributions to politicians. The Constitution is doing exactly what it's designed to do. It's protecting the interests of white landowning men. Now, maybe you're thinking, wait, didn't we correct that? Well, we tried. In the 1700s, we passed the 13th Amendment, late 1700s. The 13th Amendment was meant to abolish slavery. Well, clearly the 13th Amendment did not abolish slavery. It says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, shall be legal. We didn't abolish slavery. We codified it. We defined it. We redefined it. So if slavery is still legal through the criminal justice system, we have to take a look at our nation's incarceration rates. So the United States of America incarcerates people at an astronomically high rate. We are 100 people more per 100,000 than the next country, which is Turkmenistan. We are 5 times higher than most countries in the world. We incarcerate our citizens at a rate of 693 per 100,000. And when you break that number down by race, we incarcerate Hispanics at 831 per 100,000. We incarcerate Native Americans and Native Alaskans at 895 per 100,000. And we incarcerate Black people at a rate of 2,306. When you break the numbers out by race, we incarcerate people of color at 3 times the rate of white people here in America. Now, there was a statement made a few years ago that there are more African-American men in prison, jail, on probation, or parole than were enslaved in 1850. This was stated by Diego Arlene Morley. So some fact checkers looked into this, and they found in 1850, there were 873,000 male African-American slaves over the age of 18. The 2013 Federal Bureau of Justice statistics found that there were 526,000 African-American men in state and federal prison. There were 877,000 African-American men on probation, 280,000 African-American male parolees. That's 1.68 million African-American men under state and federal criminal justice supervision in 2013, which is 807,000 higher than were enslaved in 1850. And that's not even counting the other people of color in the nation. So in the United States of America, incarceration is currently being used as a completely legal form of slavery. Now, we also passed the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was actually in direct contrast, meant to correct the Article 1, Section 2. The 14th Amendment extended the right of citizenship to anyone born on this continent under the jurisdiction of the government. However, Section 2 of the 14th Amendment still excludes natives and still excludes women. And we can't forget that Jim Crow laws were written after this amendment. Segregation happened after this amendment. Boarding schools happened after this amendment. Massacres for Native peoples happened after this amendment. Internment camps happened after this amendment. So while this amendment, we forget that it was in 1970, Roe versus Wade, this was one of the amendments used that the Supreme Court used to now state that unborn babies aren't human and therefore they can be aborted. What this demonstrates is that the heart of our Constitution is not a value for life. There's a practice of dehumanization and the value is for exploitation and profit. This makes the Constitution of the United States a racist document that assumes the white landowning male has the authority to decide who is and who is not human. Now, in 1823, we had a Supreme Court case. This was Johnson versus McIntosh. We have two men of European descent. They're litigating over a single piece of land. One of them got the land from a native tribe. The other one got the land from the government. They want to know who owned it. The case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. The court had to decide the principle upon which land titles were based. They determined the principle was that discovery gave title to the government by whose subject or by whose authority it was made against all other European governments, and that title might be consummated by possession. They went on to rule that based on the doctrine of discovery, natives who were here first but were less than human, we only had the right of occupancy to land, while Europeans had the right of discovery to the land and therefore the true title to it. This case, along with a few others during the Marshall Court era, created the legal precedent for land titles. Now, this precedent and the doctrine of discovery were referenced by the court as recently as 2005. This makes the Supreme Court of the United States a racist court that to this day has legal precedent based on the dehumanization of people of color. Now, initially, the Protestant Church pushed back against the doctrine. This was a Catholic doctrine. They didn't fully buy into it. In 1630, John Winthrop was in the Boston Harbor, and he preached a sermon called A Model of Christian Charity. In this sermon, he referred to the colonists as a city on a hill. He's borrowing from the image of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, be a lamp on a stand, a city on a hill, shine your good deeds into this dark world. He goes on in his sermon to exhort them in all meekness, gentleness, patience and liberality, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together. Your basic Christian exhortations. However, at the end of his sermon, he's motivating the people to obey what he's saying, and he begins quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 30. So Deuteronomy chapter 30 is the passage in the Old Testament where the people of Israel are standing at the banks of the Jordan River. They're about ready to cross over to take possession of their promised land. And God is reiterating the threats and promises of his land covenant with them. If you obey me, I'll do these things for you. If you disobey me, I'll do these things to you. At the end of that passage, it says, but if our hearts shall turn away so that we will not obey and worship other gods, we shall surely perish out of the good land, whether we pass over this river to possess it. Now, Deuteronomy 30 says river, but in his sermon, John Winthrop says vast sea. Why does he say vast sea? Well, he didn't cross a river, he crossed an ocean. So what's he implying? Based on the model of Jesus, the exhortation of Jesus to be a city on a hill, based on the model of Old Testament Israel, they are at the shores of their promised land, about ready to go and take possession of it. Now, who here has read the book of Joshua? What's God's command to the people of Israel to do to the Canaanites in Joshua? Kill them all. Promised lands for one people is literally God-ordained genocide for another. Now that we have a racist Declaration of Independence, a racist Constitution, a racist Supreme Court, and a God-ordained right to commit genocide, now we have a bunch of history that we don't talk about. Oh, I forgot. So that idea percolates for about 100 years, the city on the hill idea. Middle of the 1700s, we begin expanding westward. As we expand westward, the Second Great Awakening happens. There's a renewal of churches, a growth of denominations, and it's in the early 1800s that the term Manifest Destiny is coined. This believed this nation had the God-ordained right to rule this continent from sea to shining sea. So very briefly, I want to look at the 19th century. This is the century our history books teach as our century of expansion. We added 30 new states just about to our union during this century. I did some research, and this is a graph of our nation from 1775 to 2016. Every year in blue is a year I found we were in a declared state of war or armed military conflict against another nation or entity. Every year in red is every year we were fighting against Native peoples. The wars on the bottom are primarily the wars we fought in the 19th century against Native peoples. Again, we teach this is our century of expansion. Clearly, this was an expansion. This was a century of ethnic cleansing and genocide. It was during this year, this century, that we passed the Indian Removal Act, which resulted in the Trail of Tears, the Long Walk, the forced removal of over a dozen tribes and tens of thousands of people killed. It was in this century that we had the Dakota 38, the largest mass execution in the history of our nation, ordered by President Abraham Lincoln. It was in 1864 we had the Sand Creek Massacre, 150 Cheyenne and Arapaho men, women, and children massacred in a single day. It was in 1879 we started the boarding schools. The goal was to kill the Indian to save the man. The Christian Reformed Church ran a boarding school for over 75 years in New Mexico called Rehoboth Christian School. 1890, we had the massacre at Wounded Knee, 350 Natives slaughtered in a single day. Our Congress gave 20 Congressional Medals of Honor to the U.S. soldiers who participated in this massacre. We don't teach a history of America. We teach a mythology. Instead of discovery, we say dehumanization. Or instead of dehumanization, we say discovery. Our equality is only for a select few. Instead of ethnic cleansing, we say expansion. Instead of genocide, we say exceptionalism. And the liberty and justice that we love to celebrate is literally by our own documents, only for white landowning men. This myth goes so deep. Let me bring this other one up. Yeah, we don't have time to go there yet. I'm preaching on that at Madison Square Church this Sunday. I welcome you at the Ford campus. I welcome you to come. So there's one other. So who here has been to the Lincoln Memorial? Keep your hand up. Who here has been to the museum at the base of the Lincoln Memorial? So at the base of the Lincoln Memorial, there's a museum. It's a little bit bigger than this room. On each wall, each section, there's different writings and statements by President Lincoln about his thoughts on different aspects of American life. On one wall is his writings and statements about the Union. In the middle of that wall, on a plaque about the size of one of these windows, about 4 or 5 feet tall, about 2.5 feet wide, is this plaque. It states, "I would save the Union. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing a single slave, I would do it. If I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." At the base of the Lincoln Memorial, the one safe space people of color have in Washington, D.C., there is a plaque that literally states, according to Abraham Lincoln, Black lives don't matter. These are the things we have to keep in mind when we think about the civic religious holidays of our nation. I want you to turn in groups of 2 or 3, maybe 4. Go through this list and talk for about 4 or 5 minutes about what does it look like for the church to participate, how do we give thanksgiving, and how do we lament for each of these holidays. Go ahead and just get in small groups where you're sitting. We have about 8 minutes left, so we'll have about three or four minutes to discuss, and then we'll come back together as a group to discuss them. If everyone can come back together, I know we gave you a ton of information, a huge list of holidays, and like 5 seconds per holiday to discuss them. So I'm expecting a lot of really profound, really deep insights here. Most of you might still be in shock over just some of the content we gave you. So we're also going to, but we'd love to hear some feedback. What, for just thoughts.
Questions?
I mean, I met you a year ago, Mark. And so since I met you, I've lifted up some more truths in my context to try to get beyond the mythology. And I'm just at a total loss for how to do any of those civic holidays in my church context now, because I've had people scream at me and yell at me in my office. Mm. Seriously. Yeah. How can you say those things? And I'm like, I'm just trying to lift up some truths. Like so did the two of you did. And people just
Yeah. There's this woman back.
We were just talking about engagement of people, you know, and absolving of these things it can cause the conflict. How do you engage in the dialogue? Or, I mean, for me, Mother's Day and Father's Day are some of the hardest days in churches because, you know, women who are experiencing child issues or people who are estranged from their families or children who had abusive parents. So to educate and how do we see broader, even though those aren't as civic, I think it's still a similar context of what, how to engage and educate people.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sort of a question, but also an example. So Luke was saying about his church he worked in last summer that really did 4th of July, God Bless America, singing it together. And I was wondering, like, how do you, I don't want to do false equivalencies of like this joy and the suffering is the same, but I wonder how in that context you can do that.
Yeah, one more comment and then we'll respond to a few things that were said here.
I have a question as well. I've been wrestling with this. I read your book a couple months ago, wrestling with this aspect, talking about it within my own context, which Oakland, Berkeley area. So these are conversations that are being had.
Yeah.
But the challenge that I'm having in terms of a corporate worship context is even if you write the liturgies, even if you put in the thought work, even if you lead the service, even if you teach worship and teach them as lament, if as a community, the community is not interested in the posture of lament, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And that's where I'm struggling.
Mm-hmm. One more comment, and then we'll respond to things.
Just saying that, you know, we're talking about corporate worship, which is good, and as a pastor of a church in D.C., that's important. But
But I'm also fighting, too, as a writer and a blogger and person who writes articles and stuff, the pushback I get when I put things out there that people consider heretical.
Oh, yeah.
Just to raise that up, because that's another kind of a menu where I feel like I can be a little more prophetic, a little more bold than I would necessarily be in my pulpit, because that is about the word.
Yeah.
You know, so there's still always that tension, too.
I think a few thoughts come to my mind. One of my primary goals is I know I'm not going to change the corporate worship in the American church overnight. And I love the title of Soon Chan's book, which is Prophetic Lament. So how can each of us individually be prophetic in the way that we approach these holidays and think about these things and allow even our lament to be prophetic to the church and to our community around us? But also the other thing that I'm trying to get us to do is, for many American Christians, we think God and country are equal. Like, we literally don't stop and discern. We don't stop and pause. And so what I'm trying to get people to do is, there's no right or wrong way yet to how do you approach each of these holidays. I want people to be uncomfortable, confused, and a little exasperated. That's my goal. Is if I, you know, it was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, when we had the whole debate nationally about the Confederate flag. Do you remember this? It was taken down from over the state capitol in South Carolina. There was a large debate, and the general consensus was the Confederate flag is a racist symbol that should no longer be used on the national level. I thought that was a very good debate. I thought it was happening in April, May, and June. In the middle of June, it began dying down. And then in both horror and amusement, I kind of watched everyone July 4th go out and take the day off and buy their hot dogs and watch their fireworks as we celebrate another very inappropriate racist symbol of our country, which is our Declaration of Independence. And we just don't think about these things. I had a Native friend who had a great post on his Facebook wall when Colin Kaepernick was in the height of taking the knee, and there were more and more people joining him. There was a great picture of members of the Washington Redskins football team taking a knee during the national anthem. And he tweeted that photo and he said, standing up for Black Lives Matter while wearing a jersey that says Red Lives Don't. And that's the challenge of being an American, is we don't think about these things. We don't think about this injustice and that injustice. It just becomes way too confusing. And so one of my goals is to confuse people and to make them feel, I don't know what, great. Now you know how most Black people, how most Native Americans feel almost every day of their lives when we just celebrate to no end. If you listen to the Democratic National Convention, I'll end with this and give it to Sing Chan. Democratic National Convention, so our last election, Donald Trump said, make America great again. Hillary said, America's great already. They both agree our history, our past is great. At the Democratic National Convention, Cory Booker, African-American senator from New Jersey, he, in his speech endorsing Hillary Clinton from the main stage, he acknowledged the word savages in the Declaration. He acknowledged that women and natives were excluded from the Constitution, and he acknowledged the Three-Fifths Compromise. And then he ended that section of his speech by saying, but this does not detract from our nation's greatness. I welcome you into that confusion.
Just quickly, thanks, Mark. this happens all the time. He kind of drops the bomb, and I'm supposed to come up. And I'm aware as someone who has been as a pastor, how difficult it is to kind of the course correct, right? And first of all, let me just say the feedback that I've heard from folks in here. Thank you. You're trying stuff that is not easy. You're writing in blogs. You're leading worship. And, you know, I'm just so honored that folks are, as leaders, you feel that responsibility. You know that there is a truth that you want to embody. So thank you. I mean, I know it's not easy. Some of you, your jobs might be in jeopardy because of that. You're under attack because of that. Thank you for the work that you're trying to do. I don't want to get too abstract here, but I would recommend works like Lakoff and Wink. There's very separate different types of writers. George Lakoff is a communications professor at Cal Berkeley, and Walter Wink is a theologian. Wink talks about, in order to sustain unjust systems, you need essentially dysfunctional mediating narratives. So in order to sustain kind of this broken system that we have in the church of kind of American exceptionalism, we've had to sustain some of these narratives. So how do you fight a deeply ingrained narrative like American exceptionalism? You can kind of rail against it and say, you're stupid. That's what I've been paid for the last 20 years. I go to conferences and I say that's wrong. I'm realizing it's kind of like butting your head up against the wall, and it just kind of runs its course after a while. What we need to do is offer alternative narratives. So, I remember learning once when I was in high school that the best way to bring change is the lamb chop theory, that if a dog has a bone, a chicken bone, and he's about to eat a chicken bone, and it's going to choke him because you know it's bad, but you try to pull that chicken bone away from that dog will bite you because he doesn't know any better than that chicken bone, even though it's harmful. So how do you replace that chicken bone? You can't yank it out of his mouth. You put a lamb chop in front of him, and he'll drop that chicken bone and go after that lamb chop. So I would say that, what are the alternative narratives? Now, you know, sometimes we don't begin with kind of this history, or we don't begin with, you know, the doctrine of discovery. But are we introducing the discipline of lament? And maybe there are different angles on this that opens the door for us to begin to kind of make room for other expressions as well. So it takes a long time. So my closing would be just to encourage you. Thank you for taking these themes and these ideas very seriously. But just to encourage you, it does not happen overnight. I had the real benefit of being a church planner, where I could set from day one what the culture of the church was going to be like. And even then, within a year, there was already a set culture I was trying to work against. And I know for some of you, you're at churches that have had this kind of ingrained mythology and narrative for 100+ years. So trying to work through that is going to take some time, but I think the offering of an alternative narrative is really one of the places where we need to start that.